Chapter 8. Imagine a table with only one leg. Boots Newkirk's class never knew what life lesson he had in mind when he began his lectures. He stood a copy of the 11th grade history text on end and laid his grade book off-center across its top. The class burst into nervous laughter as his shaky construction collapsed across his desk. His message that long-ago day had been on the importance of friends, or more precisely, on the absurdity of depending upon one best friend, one girlfriend, one significant other whose inevitable abandonment would result in locker slamming and tears. Better to build a community of support, Boots advised, a more complex framework with enough components to withstand change and uncertainty. He illustrated his metaphor by standing two books, then three, then four on his desktop, at last setting the grade book atop the secure base. It was a matter of simple geometry, he explained, the axiom that stability increased as forms progressed from point to line to triangle to square, the notion that the strength of a whole depended on a sufficient number of parts, each in place, and a counterbalanced tension among them. Maynard had thought from time to time about forming another band, but he'd never taken the whim seriously. He'd watched CAD dissolve as its members focused on the rush of popularity to the exclusion of details that might bring success, sensible spending and attractive flyers, commitment to creative advancement, and a shared vision of the band's future. Like the LA groups he criticized, CAD had toppled into oblivion under its own imbalance. He remembered enough guitar chords to write at least a few new songs until he could find suitable bandmates. When the challenge came to shit or get off the pot and show what I meant by you suck, the Irish side of me was like, okay, Maynard would recall, I'll show you how to do this better. Not forever. I'll show you how it's done so you can do it yourself. The madcap chaos of Green Jello was a safe environment in which to explore his art. But with his own band, he could dig deeper into his frustrations and anger. The lyrics were ready to be written, lyrics that would address the discontent and resentment simmering just below the surface, and perhaps incorporate a bit of dark humor to spice things up and keep his listeners guessing. On too many nights, Maynard lay alone in his bed while his menagerie settled into their nests. He watched the moon rise in the Hollywood sky, and brooded over disappointments and hurts he should have laid to rest long before. The view from his mother's VW of the Indian Lake house growing smaller in the distance. His wary walk, armed and cautious, down dark Grand Rapids streets. His grandmother's scorn over his punk attire. Maybe she'd been right all along. Had he accepted the West Point invitation, he wouldn't be scrambling at week's end for change to buy crickets for the iguanas. An art degree might have meant by now a supervisory position at the studio, higher pay and regular hours. The wrong turns had led to a dead end, a dissatisfaction and questioning of his every decision, the weighty sense of exile from the magic he'd believed in when he left Boston. As it was, he'd wasted nearly a year at the studio, marking time. He'd ambled long enough. The time had come to sprint.
The frustration I felt at the time is definitely what got this project off the ground then. I'd had good friends in Boston, and I'd been successful at a pet store, and I believed I was on the right path. Then I lose everything, and I'm living on $400 a month. I needed to destroy. I needed to primal scream, and I needed to be loud enough to make people go, what the fuck was that? I needed to get it out. It was that tipping point where you either become a serial killer or a rock star.
Meeting the challenge would not be a chore, but a joy, he discovered. The familiar sense of accomplishment returned as he tuned his guitar and worked out a tentative smattering of melodies and lyrics. Writing in tandem with Tom as he worked to establish his own new band energized and motivated them both. I was jamming with different people as Rage was beginning, Tom would recall. One day, Brad Wilk, a bass player named Noah, Maynard, and I were jamming and pairing riffs. Maynard was developing a brand new song called Part of Me. Back and forth the two played, creating by turns a counterpoint and a harmony of Maynard's piece and a song Tom called Killing in the Name. It was pretty clear right away that the songs fit together, Maynard would explain. We didn't actually create a song. We were just having fun. But discovering together the segues and intervals where their music meshed was encouraging, a validation that he was on the right creative track. Adding musicians to his lineup would add levels and dimensions to the music, Maynard knew. He understood the interplay of guitar, bass, and percussion, the gestalt a solo act could never yield, and he began to look at musicians who passed through the loft and the clubs with a more discerning eye. Over midnight breakfasts at Cantor's Deli, at the picnic table at the Libertyville barbecues, in the back corner of Raji's, Adam had hinted for months that he and Maynard should collaborate. He'd heard the CAD cassette, seen Maynard's Green Jello performances, and upped his urging after Mother fizzled. But Maynard had remained resistant. I hadn't seen what Adam was capable of, he would recall. I knew he was a successful special effects makeup artist at Stan Winston Studio, but I wasn't sure what he could do musically. He'd observed Adam's slow and meticulous process in assembling Mother, slower at least than that of Maynard, who, once he embarked on a project, whether an aviary or an 800-mile walk, worked obsessively to complete it to perfection. And he wasn't about to deal with the same lack of commitment he'd seen in the Grand Rapids bands. Unless his new bandmates shared his hunger to succeed, he knew the group would stay together for no more than one or two loft parties. But Adam was persistent, and Maynard began to take his interests seriously. It didn't matter who I got into the room, Maynard would explain. The band would have a different vibe with the different people, so it didn't make much difference at that point who it was. Any reservation I had about working with specific people was irrelevant. I had an idea, and I was going to see it through. It was up to Maynard to communicate his vision. The pure simplicity of the arrangements, the minimalist sonic approach, the archetypes of pain and redemption underlying the lyrics, the raw emotion reflected in guitar and clashing cymbals. Once the others agreed on the parts that must be in place, individual differences would take care of themselves. The geometry of this table we were building was very basic, Maynard explained. It wasn't Victorian. It was four legs with a top on it. A very simple structure. If somebody was going to start doing guitar solos and noodling everywhere, this just wouldn't work. Maynard invited Adam to jam on a basic song structure, and recognized immediately his rhythm skills, his methodical pace that reflected commitment to his craft, and he had no doubt he'd lay down a firm base for his words and fury. Adam was no noodler. Adam brought one afternoon to Danny's rehearsal space a new Stan Winston co-worker, a Spokane transplant who spent his days creating special effects until his dream of working in film might come true. Paul Damour's skills at the pool table were matched only by his proficiency on bass. A member of a number of Washington bands that had never quite gotten off the ground, he was eager to audition for a part in any new group with even a whiff of success about it. Maynard leaned forward when Paul began his aggressive picking, a style he immediately imagined enhancing the song he'd been working on that morning. Paul was an ideal candidate to fill in on bass, Maynard told Adam, at least until a full-time player might turn up. Identifying a suitable percussionist was another matter altogether. The Green Jello Loft was a revolving door of artists and musicians, an ever-replenishing talent pool if one were assembling a pickup band for an impromptu show or a party, unless one needed a drummer. In Hollywood at that time, Bill Manspeaker would explain, everybody wanted to be a singer or a guitar player, and that's it. Next was a bass player. But a drummer? Forget it. That was the hardest thing to find. The drummers Maynard and Adam met failed to appear for their auditions, or if they did, couldn't grasp Maynard's plans for the band. They came through Danny's loft, past his foosball machine and high school basketball trophies, and under the inflated pterodactyl suspended from the ceiling, and never once commented on the decor. Their apathy only reinforced Maynard's fear that his venture would be a repeat of Grand Rapids. He waited for no-show after no-show, calculating Danny's rental fee while the rehearsal space sat unused. "I felt kind of bad when their drummers weren't showing up," Danny would recall, "and I really wasn't doing anything, so I decided to play with them since my drums were already set up there." With Adam and Paul and Danny on board, Maynard breathed a sigh of relief. Their combined expertise and experience would surely get the band off the ground. With any luck at all, they'd remain interested long enough to help discover its potential, or at least its direction. Before they'd played their first number, Maynard began to plan the practical aspects of their partnership. He assessed the venture in the same way he'd assessed a pet store layout or a video shoot.
"When I was on the high school cross-country team, I'd walk or run the entire course before the race. I'd identify the hills, the pitfalls, the puddles and the mud, the choke points and the opportunities. I'd make the courses my own, even though I never set eyes on them before. And that's what I do now."
He'd make sure the pieces were in place. The budget, the equipment, the devotion to a common mission, and set out with military precision the rules they must keep if they were to succeed. 5 days a week, he told them, rehearsals would begin at 11 a.m. sharp. "I wasn't going to accept any excuses," he recalled. "No, I gotta do laundry, or I'm too drunk. If I was going to do this, I didn't want to be fucking around. We were going to do this right, or we weren't going to do it at all." The new band would need new songs, of course, and rough melodies were there to be refined, half the lyrics, too. For years, Maynard had harbored anger and annoyance, been misunderstood, and had watched himself helplessly backslide when a goal was just within reach. If songs must be written, he had plenty of fodder. But the lyrics must reach past the personal if they were to resonate beyond the walls of Danny's rehearsal space. "In order to write effectively, you have to write from the spot you're standing in," Maynard would explain. "You have to tap into the pure emotion of where you are, but also the broader picture, the Joseph Campbell of it all." His collection of Campbell and Jung held a prominent spot on his bookshelf, and on the rare nights when the parking lot was quiet, he lay in his bunk and read of the characters that populated dreams and legends, kings and peasants, giants and gnomes, gods come down to earth in the guise of serpents and great birds. He'd come to recognize the Shinto priest and the African bushman, the ancient Pima Indians, and Noah and his sons, as no different from the leathered punk in the mosh pit or the hipster who sulked in the shadows of English acid. They must all in the end come to terms with love and sacrifice, death and resurrection, and great floods, actual or allegorical. The great equalizer was the story repeated across time and borders as each embarked on the same hero's journey, faced the same perils, suffered the same heartbreaks on their way to enlightenment. The LA youth of 1991 might not have been threatened by fire-breathing dragons, but they had their own monsters to slay, and they hungered for stories that would resonate with their fears and anger and healing quest. "Every step of that journey is an entire story in and of itself," Maynard would explain. "Every 5 minutes of a life is a story if you tap into the archetype that transcends the individual and connects to everybody." And songs could do that, he knew. Distill a story to its metaphorical essence, provide a useful allegory to spark understanding and a safe distance from which to work through one's dilemmas. He knew, too, that he must exorcise the judgmental voices that echoed in his memory, voices of his third-grade teacher, the short-sighted supervisors at the pet store, old friends threatened by his mohawk. A journey of his own through music might silence them at last. "And I needed to yell my head off," Maynard would admit. "You can't just run down the street breaking shit." According to plan, the foursome met each morning in Danny's rehearsal space, windows closed against the May breezes and the traffic sounds in the street below. They wasted no time with small talk. All that mattered was the music, their chance to dig deep into their own discontent, their frustration with dead-end jobs, and their annoyance with the derelict camp on their doorstep. Maynard envisioned the new band's sound arising at the intersection of Born Without a Face and Joni Mitchell, and used as a foundation his old CAD songs. The music must depart from expected 2-4 and 4-4 time signatures, he told Adam and Paul and Danny, must break conventional boundaries, take harmonic risks on the way to revealing the band's style. On a typical morning, Danny might improvise a groove while Adam and Paul jammed a free-form interpretation. Then they picked up the pace, infused the melody with a sudden brutality and then a balancing vulnerability, until the song culminated at last in the solid rhythms that formed the framework for Maynard's spare lyrics. I felt the band was something special from the very first time the four of us played together, Danny would recall. The hair on my arms was standing on end. It had a power I could feel instantly. The flame of those guys. I told them I wouldn't charge them rent anymore and that I would play. I'd do this for myself because I loved playing that kind of music. Within the parameters Maynard insisted upon, the group nonetheless discovered freedom, a creative leeway to experiment at will within the messy disorder of half-memorized guitar riffs and in-progress verses in a true punk atmosphere of egoless collaboration. Not that individuality was compromised for the sake of the collective. Quite the opposite. The band members not only respected their own strengths, but attuned to each other's every nuance, drew instinctively from the collective energy to complete fully formed songs, sometimes in as little as a day, a week at the most. Everybody was really open about letting an idea go and just be drawn and quartered and turned into something else, Danny remembered. It was a healthy process and really inspiring because the possibilities were endless. The members of CAD had never quite understood Maynard's vision, his emphasis on trimming the music to a sonic minimum. But Danny and the others seemed to intuitively grasp the concept. Maynard played for Paul the da-da-ch-da-da riff that opened Burn About Out, the CAD song Chris Ewald had urged him to pursue. Paul spontaneously broke in with a funky wave of sound that buoyed Maynard's lyrics just as he'd always imagined. Then Danny fell upon his drums at the precise interval where Maynard had felt the need for deep bass. He created reverberation that shattered the song into a cubist version of the original, a slowed, chunky rendition that reduced it to its primal simplicity. And Maynard added the most primal sound of all, the deep, throaty scream, the sustained cadence of birth and new beginnings.
We were four people listening to each other and making songs that were based on songs, not on a hat. It wasn't like, Chili Peppers and Nirvana are popular now, so let's wear flannels and funny cat in the hat hats. How about no flannels, no cat in the hat hats? Get rid of all the fluff, don't worry about all that shit. Focus on the point of the story and the sounds and the energy that will drive it home. The primal scream was the key to making it sound sincere. This thing needed to punch you in the face, back up, extend a hand and hug you, and then punch you in the face again.
It did have a different sound, Danny said of the band's music. I just didn't think it would ever have any commercial possibilities. One last piece of the puzzle remained, one final detail to bring the concept to reality. The band needed a name. It must be catchy, brand new. Not in the least derivative or gimmicky, an intriguing name that suggested a backstory, a name they could live with for a long time should the band actually succeed. While they riffed and jammed and jotted down lyrics, one of the four might spontaneously shout out a word or a phrase, a potential candidate dismissed often as quickly as it was proposed. Nothing seemed to quite hit the mark. Until one or another of them flippantly suggested a word that silenced the guitars and cymbals. Tool Shed seemed entirely fitting, a name that brought to mind the shadowy outbuilding where a menacing uncle might bring a young charge for a beating, or worse. It implied the mystery and terror of the themes that wove through the emerging songs, the recurring motifs of violence and outright horror, the pain and tears necessary for healing to begin. Less was more when it came to a name, Maynard knew. His merchandising work at Boston Pet had taught him that much. Parring the name would lend space where multiple meanings might arise. Lop it in half, and the word could mean whatever one wished. The right gizmo for the job, or a blind and unquestioning follower. It might evoke the image of an implement digging deep to touch a nerve, or a midnight spin down Sunset Boulevard in a Corvette ragtop. And if the name was a double entendre, it couldn't hurt. Maynard spoke the word aloud, whispered it, sketched it in his notepad. It was a fine name for a band, they all agreed, a name with pleasing mouth feel and eye appeal. It elongated open vowels bounded by sturdy consonants, a one-syllable name that left room for interpretation, a hard-to-forget name, a solid name. Tool. Green Jello just got signed, Manspeaker would recall. Of course we've got to have a party. And of course, Tool would perform. If past parties at the loft were any indication, this one was sure to be an event, complete with revelers spilling to the roof deck and the parking lot, and sure to annoy the neighbors who operated the design firm on the other side of the common wall. Musicians and writers and aspiring painters descended upon the squat white building on Hollywood Boulevard that mild June evening, toting Heineken and Corona and Sun Chips, and sidestepping the vagrants who'd begun to assemble outside Regal Liquors. They climbed to the loft, where they joined Adam's co-workers and the Libertyville crowd, friends of friends of friends, and green jello pigs in their offstage blacks and leather. Tom Morello arrived, and tattooed young punksters befriended at Raji's and Club With No Name, and Kevin Coogan, who'd introduced Manspeaker to Zoo Entertainment. One corner had been cleared of foam and discarded department store mannequins in various stages of dismemberment, raw materials for green jello costumes, to make room for Danny's drum kit and a portable amp. Nearly 100 guests crowded the loft, curious to learn just what this new band might offer. At last, Maynard and Danny and Adam and Paul set down their drinks and took their places. It had been a long time since CAD's Top of the Rock show, a long time since Maynard had performed his own music. Adam took up his Gibson Silverburst and Paul his Rickenbacker, and from the moment Danny began his staccato intro, Maynard's old confidence returned, and with it, the surge of all that had brought him to this place. He sang of the heady intoxication of dreams come true, and the inevitable letdown, the urgency to begin again in the face of naysayers who dared dictate his thoughts and words. His words were his own now, his band's, and he sang. The guests looked from one to the other, astonished by Maynard's sure, even voice, his control, the athletic contortions and menacing crouch that punctuated his guttural, sustained scream. Tool's music rose in a swell of offbeat tempos, then ebbed in quiet minimalism, and mounted again, Danny's drumsticks a furious blur, and Adam's powerful chords and chiming arpeggios echoing from the high ceiling, until the plush Fred and Barney dolls suspended from the exposed beams vibrated. The sudden clamor brought partiers down from the roof. They listened transfixed to Maynard's lyrics of fear and sacrifice, shadows and empty promises and threats of violence, lyrics they suspected were about more than they seemed, as if their own fears were shouted beneath the canopy of twinkling white lights strung among the rafters. It didn't take long for a report of the event to reach the other side of the continent. The next morning, Tom phoned Jack Olson, who'd moved not long before to Connecticut. More than two decades later, Jack remembered well the note of wonder in his friend's voice. "Tom was shaken by the performance," he would recall. "What I heard was the expression, 'fully formed from the head of Zeus.'" They'd shared hot dogs with Maynard and Adam at many a Libertyville barbecue, battled them in countless midnight bowling tournaments, but they'd seen no sign of the creative fury Tool had displayed the night before. Adam and Maynard were two people who could not have been, it seemed, further from the world of rock, Jack would recall. Adam was the special effects makeup guy, and Maynard was something we couldn't quite put our finger on. But on that night in the loft, Maynard and Adam, and Paul and Danny too, had come together in a force that belied their placid demeanors, a force larger and more complex than its individual parts. Tool's debut performance had been a collective release of sound and emotion, a wave of contagious energy that swept the party guests in words and rhythms, driving and terrifying and familiar and continuing relentlessly into the morning. Just before dawn, guests made their way down the narrow staircase to the street, calling over their shoulders approval and congratulations and a request that Tool entertain at a private party at the Central later that month. "I've never been more surprised in my life," Tom would recall. "Tool was awesome from day one. It was unbelievable." There was Maynard, this kind of quiet dude, and all of a sudden, he's loud and he's singing these angry songs, Bill Manspeaker remembered of the loft performance. "This crazy guy with long hair screaming about shooting people in the fucking head." Manspeaker had seen the video of CAD's 1987 cable television appearance, had noted Maynard's dramatic gestures, his strutting and head tossing and motions choreographed to mimic those of the idealized rock star. "You can see the musician in him, but he's playing the musician role," he would recall. "They're all trying so hard in that video. Then he joins Green Jello, and we're telling him, don't try hard at all. Just be goofy. Be yourself. Be what you want to be, man." Brief as it had been, Maynard's stint with Manspeaker's band had freed him to relax into an organic interpretation of sound and words and message. "The first loft party was the decision point," Maynard would explain. "I could be the actor in Green Jello and play a part. I could keep doing this thing that was completely awesome chaos, or I could follow this opportunity to actually express my own ideas. Green Jello was fun, but it would always be Bill's thing, and I would just be a performer in the circus." The Central on Sunset was acrid with the lingering aroma of stale beer and cigarettes. Danny struggled to fit his drum set on the shallow stage that ran along one wall, and the others crowded in beside him. The 100 or so birthday party guests hadn't come to hear the band. They were there for the free-flowing drafts, to fete the guest of honor, to socialize as best they could above guitar and percussion and lyrics of right and wrong and the wish to sleep forever. Tool was still rough around the edges, but its power was undeniable. It sounded too surprising, too full and heavy and insistent to ignore. "We just made their ears bleed," Maynard would recall. Word of the performance reached the bookers at the Gaslight, the cave-dark club behind the Ivar Theater, where Maynard and Tom had not long before seen Dead White and Blue and Liquid Jesus. Turnout was slight, not surprising at an early evening performance by a brand new group. But Tool took the stage like seasoned professionals, holding back nothing and executing the songs with the same forceful confidence they'd displayed at the Loft and the Central. A few patrons looked up from their Budweisers, surprised to recognize the vocalist as the hot dog shooter from English Acid. And the next day, they told their friends about the show. Not a day went by that a musician on some L.A. street corner didn't hastily press a leaflet into Maynard's hand, a slip of paper he misplaced or tossed just as quickly. The quarter-page notices were covered to their edges with poorly reproduced photographs and amateurish cartoons, crazy quilts of myriad typefaces competing for attention on a maize or purple background. But Tool's flyers were simple and elegant, the message understated. At the center of full-size crimson or snow-white sheets, Maynard placed one inch-wide, ink-black word: Tool. Across the bottom, in sharp, clear lettering, he listed the date, location, and cost of admission.
People would complain and tell me I was wasting paper. I would show them other flyers and ask what they were all about. Of course, they didn't know, because there's too much noise on the page for them to remember any of it. But ours sunk in. I was handing out flyers one day, and Denita Sparks from L7 and her bass player Jennifer Finch came out of one of the clubs. I think it was English Acid. They both took a flyer and went, "This is genius." They were like, "Oh, dude, look at what you just did. This is awesome." I was really into the band's fury. They were like the Ramones to me. It was great to be validated by them, of all the people that I saw that day.
Within weeks, Tool had 5 shows under its belt, shows that drew ever larger audiences to the LA dive bars that still booked unknown acts. A half dozen devoted punkettes had appointed themselves the band's first groupies and faithfully followed Tool from the Gaslight to Raji's to Club Lingerie to Al's Bar downtown. "It was a surprise, I'm sure, to all of us," Danny would say of the band's sudden popularity. "We had so many musician friends trying to make it, but we knew we had something really special. I didn't even care if we made it or not." Maynard and the others knew it wasn't exactly time to quit their day jobs. Bookings were sporadic, and more often than not, last minute. They might be called to perform on a weeknight after a long day's work, but they schlepped their gear across town to take the unenviable first or second spot in the evening's lineup of 6 bands, a spot that paid nothing. Club owners believed exposure was compensation enough, that a draft on the house was sufficient exchange for 20 minutes on the stage. Printing t-shirts and more flyers would cost money, money the band members did not have. But Maynard had been through this before, and knew renting time in a studio wouldn't be necessary. In late August, the band invited Adam's friend, Steve Hansgen, to join them at the loft with his Fostex 4-track to record the songs they'd completed only 2 months before. Steve, a bass player with punk band Minor Threat, invited the group to sit in while he put the finishing touches on the tape in his home studio in North Hollywood.
It was one of those moments when you fall in love with a house. Oh my God. I had no idea there was something like this in LA. It was a real home. It had a backyard with a front yard and a big tree in it. It looked like a gingerbread house. I felt almost excited enough to go look for the oven.
Adam sketched a striking logo to illustrate the glossy black J card, a combination open end and double box wrench that suggested strength and authority. His design displayed a certain salty innuendo as well, a hint of humor to balance the intensity of the 6 tracks on the self-titled cassette. Business was business, Maynard insisted. There would be no freebies, even for those claiming to be record company reps. If they wanted to be a part of what we were doing, they could pony up their $6 and go listen to the tape, he would explain. I didn't need their record deal. I just needed to be up here doing this. The goal of most new bands was the record contract, the golden prize at the end of the dive bar tunnel. Maynard had watched too many of them hand out demo tapes like candy tossed from a float in an Independence Day parade, hoping against hope their work would fall into the hands of an eager A&R rep. Their priorities were way out of line, he remembered. The most important thing was to focus on the music, make sure all the pieces are in place, do things properly and for the right reasons, and don't get sidetracked. The A&R reps who prowled the clubs were indeed searching for the next Nirvana, the next REM, the next band that would bring to their label fortune and acclaim. But identifying the next big thing before it quite existed was a challenge, given that they weren't exactly sure what sound or message or even genre they were looking for. Of one thing they were certain: the band that would justify their investment would be one that excited the public. By early September, there was no doubt about it. The public's enthusiasm was centered on Tool. When Maynard and Danny and Adam and Paul appeared on the bill, the little clubs were packed. Tool was the band that delivered exactly what they'd come for: furious aggression tempered by subtle humor, ambiguous lyrics that demanded attention, solid musicianship, and the shock of unexpected tempo. And a wiry, manic frontman With a piercing scream and an unrelenting stare, he fixed on the middle of the captivated crowd. The clubs Tool played that summer weren't the glittering, sold-out arenas rock star dreams are made of. They were cramped and dark, and their kinked mic cables were mended with fraying gaffer tape. A patina of grime covered the mismatched chairs and unsteady tables, and in some, like the Gaslight, water seeped onto the stage from the men's room upstairs. Taking a slot on their schedule was a rite of passage as aspiring bands ascended in the L.A. music hierarchy. "If you went on at 6 o'clock, you're a fucking loser," Bill Manspeaker would explain. "If you went on at 11, that means you're kicking ass, and soon you're going to be playing on the Strip. Bands that weren't good enough yet played at places like the Coconut Teaser. The club's just at the edge of cool."
A wrestler has to bring his best game to the mat. You can't worry about whether your opponent is in tip-top condition, and you can't worry about whether the audience is all open-minded and ready to like what you're doing. It doesn't matter if it's a shallow stage, whether there's 2 people or 200 in the audience, or if there's pee coming down on your head. You have to adapt to morph through the space and command it.
Lou Malia rarely ventured into the clubs. He left it to his reps to endure the stale cigarette smell and beer-sticky floors in their search for promising new talent. But in early September, he'd decided to join them at Gazzari's, a fixture on LA's waning hair metal circuit. That evening, the club would host Dumpster, the hottest band on Zoo Entertainment's radar, and Malia welcomed the chance to see for himself what the underground favorite might bring to his label. Kevin Coogan and his A&R colleagues, Anna Loynes and Matt Marshall, looked forward to the performance as well, but admittedly with an ulterior motive. Dumpster's show would end in plenty of time for them to reach the nearby Coconut Teaser and Tool's 10 o'clock performance there. Kevin had told his co-workers all about the loft party, and when he'd played Tool's demo tape for Anna and Matt, they'd agreed that the band was destined for success, and they were determined that the label to represent them would be theirs. But they played their plan by ear. "As good as Tool was, I was a bit nervous to have the president see them after seeing Dumpster," Matt would recall. "We figured if they killed it, it might not be the best night for him to see Tool." The night, in fact, was not one of Dumpster's best. The band was unfamiliar with the club, and the early showtime drew a sparse audience. To make matters worse, only a few seconds into the opening number, drummer Kelly Scott came down hard on his pedal, plunging the beater squarely into his kick drum head. The group soldiered on as best it could, until vocalist Robert English leaned into his mic and announced that their set was over. "After one song, they left the stage," Matt would recall. "It was absolutely crazy." "Their evening needn't end," Malia's team assured him. A new band was playing just down the street, a band featuring Danny Carey of Green Jello. "I wasn't excited," Malia admitted in a 2014 interview. "But the night was young, and it was over as far as Dumpster went, so I said, yeah, let's go down there and see what's going on." And they made their way through the yellow LA twilight to the Coconut Teaser, the club at the eastern end of Sunset, the point where the cool began. A small but enthusiastic group of Tool followers stood in a semicircle before the stage, the half-dozen young women who'd trailed them from club to club all summer long. Adam and Paul began their guitar intro, and Maynard grasped his mic, crouched, and glared menacingly about the room. The stage burst in a rush of raw energy, in Maynard's dark lyrics, his strut across the stage, his scream suspended in the smoky dark. "All I could think was that Maynard was a musical Charles Manson," Malia remembered. "He was frightening. He didn't have a shirt on, and he had a big scorpion tattoo from his neck to his ass. When he sang, he tucked in his stomach like he was going to throw himself up from inside himself." The band had been forewarned of Malia's possible presence, but they performed that night no differently than they did in rehearsal or a show on a too small, urine-soaked stage. They dominated the space, made it their own, poured their passion and their fear and their need into every nuance, every anguished note. That's what we did every night, Maynard explained. It was Malia's job to imagine. The coconut teaser was just the coconut teaser. The Hollywood night, a night like any other. But he visualized the band in larger venues, bright venues with state-of-the-art sound systems and colored spots following Maynard's contortions across the stage. And his vision was already in the present tense. My first thought was, yeah, he's great in a club. He's very impressive when you're standing 5 feet away from him. But what about in a stadium, he would recall. Can he scare the shit out of people like he's scaring the shit out of me here? After the show, Malia turned to make his way to his home in Beverly Hills, but not before leaving Anna with instructions, classic Hollywood instructions. Tell them to come to my office tomorrow, he said. Malia smiled across his wide desk. Zoo Entertainment, he assured Maynard and Danny and Adam and Paul, would offer what other labels would not. Should they decide to sign with him, and he sincerely hoped they'd decide to sign with him, they'd enjoy creative control over their work, and because his was a small independent label, they could always speak directly with him, free of the corporate chain of command. To be sure, he warned, they'd soon be targeted by other labels, now that Zoo was interested. He alerted them of the tantalizing tactics the reps would employ to divert attention from the risks, the dazzling future they'd offer, the Nova Scotia lobsters, the $400 bottles of wine. And after the band had heard it all, he promised, he'd be there waiting when they were ready to talk again. Indeed, once word of Zoo's interest in Tool hit the street, ponytailed reps from Sony and Mercury, from Atlantic, Interscope, and Epic descended upon the group and pressed embossed business cards into their hands. They arranged lunch meetings at Sushi Nozawa, dinners at Marino Ristorante and The Palm, where they discussed funding and promotion and painted a future of spotlit arenas filled to capacity and slots on the Billboard 200 chart.
It was exciting, but I was wary. I heard enough Hollywood horror stories and I was very cautious. I immediately started looking for the escape route in case somebody tried to fuck me up. If I'm going to run this cross-country course, how do I know I can finish without them putting up construction halfway through? I needed to ask the right questions to find out how they might trip me up and interrupt the job I needed to do.
Certainly, filet mignon was seductive fare after months of ramen noodles and takeout from the Thai restaurant across the street. But the spellbinding haze cast by the A&R reps was no match for Maynard's long practice in remaining clear-headed in the face of empty rhetoric. He'd learned a long time ago the importance of thinking for himself, and as the sommelier brought another bottle of 89 Montrachet La Guiche to the table, he sat back on the upholstered banquette and offered his goblet. "I got a glimpse of what power was and how quickly it could be abused," Maynard would remember of the label's over-the-top courtship rituals. "So you play with it. If you can pretend they're wearing bunny ears while you're eating their expensive food, it's the most exciting time in your life." Ahead lay contract negotiations, discussions of album art and liner notes, foreign rights and royalties, a journey a band might be lucky to embark upon after months and years of performance and practice, but one he and Danny and Adam and Paul were beginning after only 7 shows. In second-rate clubs. One afternoon in late autumn, Maynard came home to a message from yet another bubbly club manager offering yet another unpaid gig. "Tool should come play third in a 6-band lineup," she urged. "Danny would use the club's drum kit, of course, but the engagement would give them great exposure, great experience, and drinks on the house." "I called her back," Maynard recalled. "I told her, 'Here's the deal. We'll play next to last on our own drum kit, and you'll pay us $100. She snapped back, "Who do you think you are?" So I said, "I'm the guy you're going to call back very soon when you realize that you need us." And after discussions of branding and percentages, options and advances and exclusivity clauses, after luncheons rolled in on white-linened carts by white-linened chefs, the band came back to Malia. Of the many label execs they'd met, he was the one who best understood Tool's message and methods, the importance of its creative integrity. "I'm not asking you to give me a budget for each video," he told them. "I'm asking you to do videos the way you want to do them, and I'll pay for it." "I felt like the things I'd done all my life were finally leading up to something," Maynard remembered. "This was my chance to do it right. You can't keep building two-legged tables and bitch about them not standing up." Working with the independent subsidiary of BMG would offer them nearly the same freedoms as if they'd remained independent themselves, the group realized. And, Malia assured them, Zoo's energies and budget would be directed toward what mattered the most, live performances. "Not everybody said that," Maynard would remember. "What we heard from most of the labels was basically, we're a big machine and we can force you down people's throats." Together, Malia assured the band, they could surely create an artistically satisfying and financially sound agreement. "It was very much a democratic process," Danny remembered of the negotiations. "At every meeting, all four of us fought tooth and nail for ourselves, kind of like musketeers, which was really a good thing for all of us." Tool had formed out of curmudgeonly frustration, had burst with little preparation on the city's club scene, had unquestioningly responded to Malia's request to meet with them. Signing with his label after only 7 performances would be one more act of faith. "There's a sense that all of this just fell into place," Maynard would explain, "but most of it was just dumb luck and trust. You step over the edge into darkness. The bliss finds you." On the day before Thanksgiving, 1991, the agreement was finalized, an unusual deal considering that Tool hadn't yet recorded an album. Zoo would produce an enhanced release of the band's demo cassette, a 6-song EP, and later a full album, and, true to Malia's promise, would provide greater-than-average tour support. The agreement granted the band creative control and provided for an advance to cover expenses and equipment until royalties began rolling in. "Tool was the only band I ever signed that had my complete trust and support whenever they needed it," Malia would recall. The deal included one more provision, a clause that wasn't set forth in the contract, but one the band members considered as important as all the others. Maynard and Danny and Adam and Paul were committed to pastimes and passions discovered long before they'd come together as Tool, and they were determined their private lives would remain just that. Whatever demands and responsibilities they'd just signed on for, they promised one another, books and barbecues, magic and mythology, friends and family, and finches would come first.
"I didn't want to be an animal on display. I needed to find a brake pedal to slow down elements of this opportunity and figure out how to emotionally process it. What was all this attention going to do to me? What would it do to my body? My emotional body, my spiritual body, my mental body, my physical body. I had goals, and being famous wasn't one of them."
The paperwork signed, Maynard and Danny and Adam and Paul stepped from the Zoo Entertainment office into a city that seemed spread about them like a stage set for a performance all their own. Their first stop was the Palace, the vast Art Deco establishment on Vine, already filled with a club crowd eager to begin the long Thanksgiving weekend. "We went in like we were hotshots, like we're a big deal," Maynard recalled, "and we proceeded to get extremely drunk." They roamed the main floor and the balcony, their shouts ringing loud above the music. A band could celebrate its first signing only once, they rationalized, and celebrate they would. Until, in an excess of exuberance, an upended tray of shot glasses shattered in bright shards under the spotlights, and the bouncers requested they move their revels elsewhere. They joined the crush of hipsters at the Frolic Room just around the corner, the narrow, dim dive bar where they fed the jukebox and sang along from their red swivel stools, ignoring their rising bar tab until the ceiling lamps flashed, signaling closing time. They stumbled to the sidewalk, their stagger a disjointed victory dance up the boulevard to Regal Liquors and the cooler at the rear of the store. "We came back to the loft, hooting and hollering," Maynard recalled. "We were out of our minds and just free." They drained their coors and pelted the empties about the parking lot until their shrieks and laughter and clattering brought the neighbors to their window with the promise of a visit from the LAPD. They scattered into the Hollywood night, Danny to his loft, Paul to his apartment, and Maynard, Adam, and Manspeaker to a nearby cab and its reluctant driver. Adam's apartment in the valley would be safe enough haven until the fracas blew over.
"We could have had integrity and been nice, but we chose to be dickheads because we were young and we were suddenly empowered. We were flexing. And everything you grow up seeing, you assume that that's how a rock band is supposed to act. There's no excuse for any kind of violence. I just don't do that. Our actions weren't directed at anybody in particular. But we've been beaten down, and finally there was a light."
In the morning, they searched in hungover stupor for a market open for business and returned to Adam's apartment with strong coffee and one of the last butterballs to be found in the city. And Maynard and Adam and Manspeaker, newly signed performers with every reason to enjoy their holiday in style, passed a cold and windy Thanksgiving day, searching cupboards for a pot big enough to hold the bird and for ingredients of a passable turkey soup. Adam had failed to mention that his oven didn't work, Maynard remembered. It was a dreadful fucking day. News of Tool's recording deal elevated the band's status almost overnight. Club managers, who only weeks before had relegated the band to 6 o'clock shows, called to offer choice spots in their New Year's lineups. And Maynard's demands that had seemed baseless hubris a month before were now perfectly justified. Tool would headline, he told the bookers. The band would use its own gear, and their rate was now $500. More than fair remuneration for a group surely destined for stardom. Sensible as his requests were, Maynard didn't mind when they were refused. Tool had New Year's Eve plans of its own. Weary of Manspeaker's blowouts, the neighbors had at last relinquished their lease. Their departure meant an expansive addition to the green jello space. Maynard and Manspeaker brought out hammers and saws and opened the common wall to create a home theater complete with projection room and doubling the space for parties. On New Year's Eve, the loft was packed as any club on Sunset. Punksters and rockers arrived, and actors and artists and curious passers-by were drawn up the narrow stairway by the music that blared down into the street. Quantities of schnapps and Corona and Kahlua glimmered beneath the colored lights strung from the rafters, and a mobile sound truck was parked in the lot to record the night's performances. The Green Jello Troupe reprised its little pig antics, and then Tool took up its guitars and drumsticks and mics and filled the new space with driving lyrics of fury and fear, right and wrong, sacrifice and shadow and pain. Maynard's scream rose that night with new intensity, a deeper sincerity born of elation and triumph. His was a cry of retaliation for a lifetime of misunderstanding, a wall of defiance against hurdles that might lie ahead. And his strong, sure song continued into the first gray dawn of the new year.